Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 680.
I am Chris Hardwick. I am here with Kyle Clark and Katie Levine.
Hi, guys.
We're making the intro special. Nerdist Community Corkboard.
Yeah.
Events at Nerdist.com.
It's where you send them.
Stop me or I won't stop.
I love that people are always like, hey, you know that events at Nerdist.com thing? Where's that email? I'm like, come on, guys. Let's put some words together and see what we can do. Also, it's most of my timeline on Twitter at this point. Maybe look through my mentions and see how many times I have sent.
At Kyle Clark is rad.
Yeah. So now that I've said that, I can get five more people going, like, hey, where's that nearest address?
You know, Kyle loves hearing from you, so just
I tweet
at Kyle Clark is rad and ask him where the events at nerdist.com email address is.
Oh, it's all so much of my life. If I were... You ever have that moment where you just realize you're dumb? I should tag all of the people and then just put it instead of just putting it and copy-pasting. I'm not good at the internet.
That's all right, but you are
but
good at...
this guy is... It's Peter Van Pearson, mm-hmm. or Pearsim, with an M.
Okay.
And he, inspired by listening to the show for a long period of time, decided he's been a writer but not sharing it. You mm-hmm. know, like that Emily Dickinson or something.
Yep.
Writes H.P. Lovecraft-style weird fiction. Mm-hmm. And after listening to Nerdist at some point, was like, you know what? I'm going to put my stuff online.
Good for him.
And so he's got a Wix page. You wish you'd simplified a little bit, bro. So everybody stay with me. phvanpe.wix.com/story-graveyard. I would not go through all that stuff if I didn't think his stories were awesome. I'm really proud of you, sir, because that takes some balls to put that stuff out on the internet, because sometimes that internet full of bags of dicks that are full of dicks themselves.
The dicks are just going
to
the dicks are going to try to smack your big balls around.
But Peter, I think you're doing good work there, and I've been reading some of your stuff, and I enjoy it.
Yes, and as I said, Kyle's a snob, so if he likes your stuff, that's a good thing. Katie, what do you got?
Just want to remind people to enter the contest that we are doing with Totino's to perform on our stand-up cluster podcast and also open for you at San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes, June 8th, stand-up cluster at Nerd Melt. We'll have mm-hmm. a ticket link up for that soon, and we're going to have a slew of... of fine young comedians.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's right. And then, but and one of those people, we are reserving a slot for this nationwide search.
Yes.
So go to totinosliving.com.
Exactly.
Submit your 2 to 4 minute video and just a quick little questionnaire. And yeah, thanks to them for sponsoring this. And we hope to find you on the Nerdist Stand Up Cluster.
And thanks, Totinos, for making pizza rolls because they're delicious.
Yes. This episode of the podcast is Richard Lewis, who is, of course, I mean.
He's Richard Lewis.
To understand, I mean, obviously, you know, oh, he's a very famous comedian, but, you know, a guy like this to me when I was growing up, and again, it's one of the craziest things about having this podcast is being able to sit down and have conversations, and it's sort of like that thing Judd Apatow did, you know, where it's just like, I just tricked a lot of my favorite comedians into sitting down and talking to me when I was in high school to learn about comedy. I sort of feel like that's what this is all about, and just, he's so punk rock.
He's
like,
what I want to grow up to be as a comic.
He has a lot of the punk rock ideals that you have when you first start doing comedy and then you abandon them. He still has all of them. And he's super cool dude. And he has a new book called Reflections from Hell, Richard Lewis's Guide on How Not to Live, available wherever books are sold. But it was a tremendous honor talking to him. And I got to talk... I want to see if I can get him or like Billy Crystal and to come down and do beta tests.
I keep lurking after the mic every Monday. There's a beta test going. Like I hope Billy Crystal or
the last beta test we did was super fun because it was me and my friend Elizabeth Beckwith and Megan Neuringer and Garfunkel and Oates, and they all crushed it.
Killer lineup.
You know, our audience is like a lot of the same people come back. There's a girl named Amy and she's a baker, and so every week she brings something new. She's like, oh, I know you like chai.
Yep.
So I made these little tiny little chai
she
donuts.
She kills it.
Yeah, she's killing
it. They're amazing.
Thank you, Amy. So yeah, the next time, I think beta test June 1st is, I think that's the next one's coming up. But Richard Lewis, I give you all the salutes in the world. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I believe you folks will enjoy this. This is the Nerdist Podcast number 680 with Richard Lewis.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Thank you. Of course, wearing a
suit from 1978.
You know what, though? It's a look that works very well for you.
Well, I'm working with Sir Patrick now, and I do an Enterprise thing for him just to tease him.
You're working with Sir Pat Stew.
You can yeah. Hold that if you want, by the way. You can take it out of the thing.
Well, I'll see what works best. You know, whatever.
He's a very sweet, funny man.
Oh, so you know him fairly?
I don't know him that well, but I've done.
He's amazingly great.
Yeah.
So talented and night treats people so great, and the writing is. I mean, we just wrapped the first year, and this guy Jonathan Ames is a really, God, really fragile, brilliant guy, and he I don't know. The scripts are good as far as I'm concerned. I've been around. You know, I play a shrink, which is like a punchline. And I run into some of these younger actors who I don't know by name. You know, they're like on the Big Bang Theory.
Or sure.
Hey, congratulations. They go, oh, Mr. Lewis, don't call me Mr. Lewis, please. You're doing, what a life you have, you know. I mean, they're set forever and ever. And
of course.
All good. And I go, and they go, yeah, I'm doing a series now called Blunt Talk with Sir Patrick Stewart and some really good actors. And what do you play? A shrink? And then they fall on the cement. I say, what am I, a punchline? I guess I'm apparently.
No, but everyone, you know, like everyone who knows comedy knows your act. Like they know what your act is.
But I'm doing it really, you know, I mean, I have to have some affect or it would be the worst role in history because I'm a Freudian.
Yes.
So we'd had a long discussion, me and the showrunner, like, you gotta, you know. We have to tweak this a little bit, but you could understand.
But you must have, I mean, I assume you probably have a therapist like most comedians.
I've had many.
So I feel like at this point you've put in enough hours, you might, I think if you put in enough hours, they actually go, okay, you are now a therapist.
I have the best sense memory of any actor for a therapist. I mean, I've been with so many, all different types, so. Oh, we'll save some of this.
No. Well, what is the best type of therapist?
Well, maybe you're taping this right now. Yeah. Wait a minute. Oh,
is the best type of therapist someone who basically just says, what do you think about that?
No, one that will make love with you and fly away with you. Is
That's the absolute best
yeah,
kind.
That hasn't happened.
But not yet.
Because it's nothing like, they know you so well. You just feel so safe. You would, I would imagine.
Yeah. But I can never tell.
No, what you're asking me a straight question.
Yeah.
Well, Freudian. I went to a Freudian therapist when I was a kid when my dad died, and I was freaked out, and I was a comic, and I was broke, and you lie on a couch just like I do on this new series and Blunt Talk, and I just and I bring my own couch, and they sit there, and Freudians just go yeah, and they write notes. So I had to do we had to figure out a way to make it a little more. Involved for me as an actor, you know, otherwise it would have been a nightmare, you know, and we have. But I like eclectic therapists. They use different types of therapies. I was in a therapy session when I was starting comedy. It was Adlerian, and he was the father of the inferiority complex.
Oh.
And it was, what a night. Once a week, first you'd go to the shrink, who had like 8 people in his office in Manhattan. Then you would have what we call after group, and we'd go to someone's house. And we didn't. And at that point, I was living in New Jersey, so I say, so let's say they lived in Staten Island. They go, oh yeah, I feel like Christopher Columbus driving on. And it was like a 12-hour commitment. And then we'd have after group, and then the person who had their apartment, they had little cupcakes. It was like an AA meeting, probably, you know, coffee. And then we'd talk without the shrink. And then we'd have to drive home. It was a whole day of therapy. It was a horror, really. So I brought Larry David once because I thought he needed it because I felt that he had some inferiority problems. Thank you. And someone brought me a Coca-Cola. It could have been anything. It could have been a bear, now that I think of it. And he just couldn't handle the whining of these people just complaining because it was about inferiority.
Sure.
And he ran out of someone's apartment, and he says, I don't need to hear this crap. And we chased him down First Avenue for about 5 blocks, and he hid in a phone booth. And it would have been a great fisheye lens shot of people going, you need us, you need us. And he went, I hate you.
And he never came back?
No.
Was there any point where you felt like, because I feel like when you first start writing comedy, my guess
maybe I'll ask you instead of telling you what I think happened. But it feels like when you first start writing comedy, you go, I have to do this thing called writing comedy. And then at a certain point, it really just is a part of who you are on stage, I think. Was there a point where you felt less like you were writing jokes and more like, I'm just being myself on stage, and this is a form of therapy for me to get all this stuff out? And feel like comedy?
It was definitely the latter, but it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, because when I started, you had to write monologues that had jokes that producers of The Tonight Show would find funny. So you weren't really writing for yourself as much. You were writing for other people. And they were jokes. They were one-liners, a good premise, hopefully, with a great punchline. And then you needed to have three or four of those monologues back to back to back to back. And then they come down. If they figured they had you for three or four shots, you got booked. But after a while, that got, for me at least, it got so boring because I realized that I wasn't writing really things that were really organic to how I was really feeling. Because what I really wanted to do on stage was to express my fear of me crumbling inside and have people laugh, and that would validate that, well, yeah, no, you are crumbling, but so are we. You know, the more they were crumbling, the better I felt, basically, and it made me feel less insane. So I started doing more storytelling and more riffing. And it took a while. I mean, you know, there was a mixture for a while, but now when I go, I used to bring notes on stage for decades, and it would be like, let's say I played a club in San Francisco like three times a year. Every 4 months, I'd bring 2 or 3 hours of new material, and I'd put it on a piano, and I knew that I had never said it before. So if half of it worked over the course of, say, 6 or 8 shows, that's like 2 or 3 hours.
Jesus.
And I did that in New York, I did it in Chicago, I did it in San Francisco. So like after about 5 or 6 or 7 years, I had enough television material for the rest of my life. In fact, once Letterman came down to see me in New York at Caroline's, and he was right in the front row. I went, oh, man. Because I was doing new material always. Because, you know, I always felt it was a cool thing doing new material. It was, you know, I was never afraid because I never really felt like a comedian. I felt like, you know, I didn't really have much of an upbringing. My father died before I became a performer. My brother was older, and he was in the village, probably, you know, hanging out with the Beats. My sister, he eloped when I was 12. So I was alone with my mother, who had a lot of illnesses, and so I was pretty screwed up at home. So I was tethered like to nobody. It was like a Chagall, you know, holding on to nothing, a rope to nothing, you know, and so I really needed the audience. Strangers were really... I used to remember once I used to say, God, I just came from a family reunion and I'm just so glad to be here in front of strangers. And, you know, it's not even that funny, but I really meant it because I just really despised most of them. They just didn't get it. They didn't get me. And it was like me against the world. And so the audience was really my validation of being a human being, really. And I do the same thing 45 years in my career. Like I'm going on the road now promoting a new book and a series, and I'll be doing shows. And you know, every time I do Chicago or San Francisco and a lot of the same people come, I force myself. Now that I don't have notes to look at, I stopped doing this about 8 years ago. Some agent, and I've had about 300 managers and agents. They're gone. Some of them are dead. But I'm saying I'll never have them again. I don't need them. I don't want them. I don't want to wait for them to call me. I don't want to wait for them not to call me. It's just so much easier. Good luck, you know, with you. But I mean, most of them are just, it's just a joke,
right?
And as far in my life, I mean, they're, you know, a lot of it is that they're smart and they're really smart and they're good. And it's all about money. They don't really understand you. And they usually have one or two people that are making millions of dollars. And that's where they go.
Right.
That's where they go. Like if someone's making $10 million on a movie and they're in Manhattan and they don't have a broiler, they're on a plane and getting them a broiler.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care that you don't have the right suite for a gig in San Francisco. They couldn't give a fuck, you know.
Well, it is. There is a little bit of a.
There's a real. I can.
There's a little bit of a car salesman-y kind of a vibe sometimes with some of them.
Yeah, no, some are good. I mean, I've always learned something good from my wife. Always said to me, I've been married for 10 years. We know each other for about 17 now. She says you always get a couple of great things. Like I got a good lit agent from one guy, and one guy who I was with for literally an hour and a half. This was the shortest time. He says, why don't you stop bringing your notes on stage? I go, why? I did it in Vegas. I did it in Carnegie Hall. I did it with all my specials. I said, well, you know, it hasn't stopped me. I'm doing fairly well in my career. And he says, yeah, but it's a work in progress. I went, yeah, isn't that cool? To me, it was cool. But it was more of my ego saying that, because if people pay money to see you and they see you have notes down there, now, I must say that those notes took me months to get on that long sheet of paper. It was about five feet by 3 feet. It was like gigantic. Looked like the Shroud of Turin. And when I would look down, I would look down for a second, then pop up. Let's say it said circus. I knew if I saw it and my eyes would look at the word circus and I would look down for a second, I'd pop up and I could do 20 minutes. But now, without having that there, I can't think. I won't remember 20, 30 things about the circus. I can't. I'm, you know, even if I was 20, I couldn't remember. But he said that it looks cheap to the audience that you're trying things out on them. And I thought about it. I went, oh, maybe he has a point. So I stopped bringing notes on stage. And what I had to do was like stay in my hotel. Literally, like I was in Gitmo, and I would, because I really care about each show, whether it's Carnegie Hall or a nightclub, it doesn't matter. The people are still paying to see you. And I would just spend really hundreds of hours preparing for one show. And when I had the notes, I knew I would be doing like a new 30 or 40 every show. But when I didn't have the notes, sometimes I go, why did I even spend that time? Why didn't I go to the art museum? I did 5 new lines. You know, but that's the way I have to prepare, that at least I had looked at all this new stuff, you know. But he was right, though. And I haven't had notes on stage now for over a decade, and my performance level has shot, it's skyrocketed. Because I'm so afraid when I hear my name, because I have no idea what I'm going to say. At least when I had the piece of paper on there, I knew I had 2 or 3 hours to look down at. Now I don't know what I'm doing. And I ad-lib about half my shows. And that's sort of cool.
That's not just sort of cool. That's amazing, because I think it's an idea that most young comics have, where they say, well, I'm never going to do the same set twice. And you go, well, we'll talk about that in a month and see. And then they all go, oh, I get it. You have to whittle stuff down. And there's a real craft to like making the joke solid. But to hear that you can still do that is pretty, pretty remarkable.
Well, listen, you know, it's not as if there are not times when if the audience is not that great. If the audience is great and I'm ad-libbing, I'll just go wherever I want to go and I'll just keep going until they go, oh, you know, and then you stop. But, you know, it's not like I'm not going to repeat certain areas.
Sure.
But what I do now is if I'm in an area, say, about marriage and they're laughing, I will immediately just hopefully think of something on stage that's totally different, that's not written on a piece of paper that used to be written. It's disappointing because a lot of the stuff, my wife is disappointed. She says, we got to, before you like retire from stand-up, you have thousands of pages. I mean, it's a waste. And I said, yeah. So what would I be doing? Just giving it away like Gandhi, you know? Here.
What are you going to do with it?
Yeah, go on a cruise and be a hit. I mean, some of, you know, not that it's all gold, but I mean... I don't know. I just every show is frightening. Every show is frightening. That's why I never see the audience. I remember I was doing Town Hall, and I said to the guy, I do not want to see anybody in the audience. When I did Carnegie Hall, I mean, this was in 89, I walked out there early, and I saw it. I went, wow. this is really a trip, man. And then, because I knew I would never see it again, because I made the lights so bright that I couldn't see anything. I just don't want it, because although most comics will say this, they'll look at one guy going, oh, he's Jewish, isn't he? You know, and, or start picking his nose and flicking it. And, you know, and then I'll look at one person out of 3,000 that is not happy with my show.
Oh, yeah. That's very standard.
You know, right?
That's very standard. Yeah. And I think I've started noticing that if people come to more than one show, I start to get in my head because I'm like, oh, I know they've already seen this joke and I feel really weird. It's like literally one person.
I know. No. We all have similar feelings about that. Yeah, and I remember doing when you were young and you had to do two shows a night and you had to really stretch to do two like 45-minute sets, and then someone... And if you didn't have enough material, people would say, you're good, we're staying again. No, I have a tendency to murder people. You can't. I might knife you. You don't want people to stay. You know, it's
well, comedy is like it's not like music where you could just listen to it over and over again. Like a joke is like a magic trick. And once you see the magic trick,
oh, God,
it's sort
music,
of
music. I'm so jealous. Sing Jingle Bells. Oh, but all right. It's so much. You know, I used to despise comedians that were horrific, and then at the end they would sing "America the Beautiful" and get a standing ovation. I go, wait, this is not right. You know, he sucked, and or she did, and he sings a song at the end, and they applaud. People applaud singing.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a claptrap. Anything that feels like, oh, that person put a lot of work into that. Sometimes you can see people do it where if they just say a bunch of words really fast, then people are like, oh, that must have been a... Even if there's not really a joke in it, they go, wow, what a feat.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
No, you're exactly right. No,
I almost kind of think that maybe... So let's just say someday you go, you know, I'm ready to retire. What you could probably do is go to Netflix and go, I'm going to do 12 one-hour specials. And you just burn through all of it and just put it up as a stand-up series.
That's an interesting idea.
And then you're done. You're just like purging all of your material and then you don't have to do it again.
I'll also commit suicide after I finish all 12 of them. I don't know. You know, it's an interesting idea. Otherwise, then I won't feel like I wasted all that material that I came up with, because it just pours out of me and I always have a pad with me, and I write things down all night. And I remember once when I was a kid, I used to hate to wake. Two things happened that were funny to me. I was about 24, and I said, "God, I should get." There were these new tape recorders that you would, as soon as you would speak into it, it would record. Mm-hmm. I forget what they called it. And so I would wake up and I would have a premise. I thought I had a premise. And then a punchline, then I go back to sleep, and I knew that then the tape would stop recording. But I didn't realize that I snored so much. So I woke up one morning, and I knew I had. I said, "Oh, I had wrote a great joke in the middle of the night." And then I put on the recorder. It was like, and I had to wait like 2.5 hours till I got to this horrible joke. But worse than that, I was at Shea Stadium, sold out.
Jesus.
And I had my pad next to my bed. I was living in this dump. And I was killing. It was like the Beatles at Shea, you know. And every joke, they went berserk. And I would wake up, and I wrote the premise down and the joke. I'd fall back to sleep, right back into the dream. And I did an entire set. And I woke up and I had like 70 jokes written on a pad. I went, I'm Beethoven, man. Maybe I'm Christ. Maybe I'm the Christ of comedy. I said, this is, what if I dream this every night? What if I dream? Because I killed. I hadn't looked at the pad yet, I might add. And what happens, you know, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know how to describe it, you know, in medical terms. But what I thought was killing in my dreams were just these non sequiturs. Like here would be a typical joke that got 60,000 people roaring. Blender high, lips. That's what I wrote down.
And in the dream world, it made perfect sense.
They went crazy.
And it was amazing.
Yeah. Where's the wood? Hi, how are you? I mean, it was so disappointing.
Well, there's no linear thought in your dream. Everything's just, yeah.
It was one of the most disappointing nights of my life. I thought that maybe I was, you know, special, you know, Ludwig van Lewis, you know.
Or Mozart. It's like it's being dictated by the heavens.
Exactly.
And he is a vessel. You are a vessel.
Well, it didn't happen. It didn't work.
But I think, you know, you never want to, I mean, it's very difficult to do a lot of specials near each other, you know, unless you're Louis or Aziz. But I think usually you don't want to do too many specials because then you go, well, then people... Then the next one, people go, well, they just saw that one. But if you decide, like, you don't care anymore, what an amazing idea to just, like, do a bunch of them all at once.
I could. It is a good idea.
Just so it lives out there in the
world.
But
here's the reason why I stopped. I did a lot of specials. The reason I stopped doing it is because I enjoyed ad-libbing 60 or 70% of my shows than working on my set.
Right.
There's something really to working on. You said I used to would love perfecting it. But when you used to do these, you know, all these HBO sets, the directors come down, the executives come down, and they expect us, let's hear it. And I said, I don't want to. I was sort of disgusted. I didn't feel like talking about it. Let's say I had a crazy day. Let's say I had a crazy, funny argument with my wife, and that wasn't part of the HBO special. I couldn't do it. And I felt like this is not why I'm on stage. I'm on stage to express how I'm feeling. So I could have done another 4 or 5 specials easily, but I stopped doing them for that reason. I got bored. I said, if I'm going to be bored doing this, then I'd rather just act or write or do something else. I have no interest in doing specials.
So no one ever came to you and said, well, look, we'll book a theater one night. You'll do 2 shows one night, 2 shows the next night. Say whatever you want, and we'll cut together a special.
Yeah, they have asked me, but you know there is a little bit of nervousness because when I was so used to working so hard on my specials, and you would do the same. I mean, I would do 2 70-minute sets that were fairly similar. I would ad lib a little bit, but you still had to make them pretty close. But they were killer. I mean, the lines were, for me at least, I thought were killer. And if I don't know how I'm going to do, it could be a real waste of time.
Sure.
You know, even the makeup artist might walk out.
But I don't know. I mean, at this point, I feel like you have enough experience where your brain is probably going to save you. I mean, it's like you know.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
You know how to do it. You know, I mean, there's probably more of a safety net than you realize there is, because it's all, you know, it's the you've perfected the machine without having to perfect individual jokes. The machine is intact, and that's, you know, like you could just riff about anything and you get a special out of it.
You know, I know it sounds grandiose. My wife has the same thing. When I get nervous, I said, I'm playing town hall. She says, you'll be fine. Be fine? How do you know? She says, you're funny. You just talk.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I mean, it's nerve-wracking.
Sure.
I used to be jealous of guys who did do the same set year after year. Like they would, let's say I was co-headlining with somebody and... I'd be there and be in my hotel room, and I'd order room service, and I'd be looking over thousands of jokes, you know, then in my 30s, I'd have the sheet of paper. That sheet of paper was my holy grail. I would just memorize it, look over it, like fear of intimacy, and look over the 50 things, and then whatever subject, family, you know, orgasms, whatever the hell I had written on it. And so these guys would land. I'd see them in the bar, you know, picking up chicks, getting loaded, and ordering lobster. I said, God, you're eating a lobster now, aren't we on in 20 minutes? Don't you worry about taking a crap before the show? I said, no, I don't care. Really? I mean, you have a show. And he said, I'll be fine. And the reason they'd be fine, they knew exactly what they were going to do.
Yeah.
As soon as they walked on the stage, from A to Z, you know. And I remember Leno saying to me once, we were at the Improv in Hollywood when we were in our 30s, and he said, why are you a wreck, man? because I was, you know, I was on the doing Carson and Letterman and all that. I said, because I don't know what I'm going to do. Don't you get it, man? I just don't know what I'm going to do. And I still don't.
So every set is kind of a trial by fire.
It absolutely is.
I mean, that's pretty amazing. That is a pretty...
They're not all great, by the way. I mean, you know, but they are a trial by fire.
That takes a tremendous amount of energy.
Energy?
Yes. Of course it does.
Oh, energy.
Yes,
yeah.
It takes a tremendous amount of energy.
Oh, I thought you were saying courage.
It takes courage, but it takes a tremendous amount of energy to... Because, you know, when you kind of get into that mode and it's like, okay, here we go. And then you have to be, you know, you can't check out partway through your set. Oh, I'll just do this part and then this part and this part. Like, you have to be super engaged the entire time.
Exactly.
But that's kind of the art of it, I guess. It's a different way to attack it. And I haven't heard anyone else say that, especially anyone who's been doing comedy as long as you have. So it's really... It's interesting that's your... And I never would have known that when I watched you when I was growing up. I never would have known, like, right. Oh, that just... He just is make... Wow.
Well, you know, they would ask me... I used to have arguments with producers from the talk shows. They would say, what do you want to talk about? And I go... I say, why are you asking me this? This is after, like, 15, 20 years. I go... Hawaii, God, my toes, and a shirt. Is that good? Will that be good enough? But that wasn't good enough because their job, these young producers, whatever they were called, they had to give notes to Letterman and Carson and whomever, Conan, and you know, all of them. And they had those little notes there. And it used to make me crazy because they would say, hey, I understand you in Hawaii. And I go, and I felt like saying, what are you, a psychic? How did you know I was in Hawaii? You know, that's how I felt. I felt it sucked away all the spontaneity of the way I worked. And I never really felt comfortable. So I ultimately had to tell them, look, I'll give you subjects, but you know, if you don't want me back, fine. But I, you know, I'm not sticking to them. I'll, you know, if I have a funny day, I'm going to talk about it. And you know, they never, you know, I never got thrown off a show. If you score, you don't get thrown off a show.
Sure.
But you know, it takes a lot of balls to do that, I guess. And I understand why. I mean, I don't really understand. I mean. I bum me out a lot of the times because, I mean, it's one thing if you let's just say you're an unfunny actress who's in a soap opera. Then, you know, you don't want to just to sit there and, you know, you want to say, so I understand that you have a pet monkey. Yeah, oh, God, yeah, this monkey, Chi-Chi. And then, you know, that's 3 minutes. Because when you think about it, they're on for 8 minutes. The host will talk four. Chi-Chi the monkey's 3 minutes and they're off. Oh yeah, I'm doing a movie. Oh, congratulations, ladies and gentlemen, Jeannie Shalman. You know, so it's the whole thing is like when you think about it, if you're doing one segment, you know, and this is something I like to for young comics listening to this. I was really wrong for decades. I remember, like, I would prepare, particularly for Letterman, I did. In fact, I'm going to do an interview, a two-minute interview, I guess, for one of his, maybe his last show. I don't know what it's for, but because he understood me. And in 82, I went into his office and he says, you know, you do fine on Carson. And he says, you know, you're like an animal on stage. He says, you know, it's not good for the camera. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you're all over the joint. You know, like Jack Benny would be the perfect guy to look into the lens. But if you're running all over the place, it does look amateurish. And he says, you know, you can come on. He said to me, you can, not only did he ask me to write for the show, but he said, you can come on the show as often as you want, but never do stand-up again. You'll only do panel. And usually back in those days, you only did panel when you had a series. So I did the Tonight Show because it was Johnny. But I started to do it when they had guest hosts because they would let me do panel.
Mm-hmm.
because I was better doing. I was like a nutcase, like squirming in my chair, and I never did stand up again, ever. And some shows, sometimes they get new producers. They're 22, 23 years old. Oh, no, you have to do stand-up. I go, do stand-up? I haven't done stand-up. I don't want to do stand-up. Then I just won't do the show. You know, because it's not this, you know, if you had a chance to, I don't want to mention names now, but there was some, I did a great set a year ago, and then all of a sudden I was going to come back and promote the series, and they said, well, can you do 6-7 minutes? I go, no, I'm not going to do stand-up. What is this, open mic night? That's what it would feel like for me.
Yeah.
A lot of guys like to do stand-up. I don't do stand-up on television, except if it's a special.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't done those in a couple of years, many years. And but it's not if I had a chance to, and if I would run into this guy at a restaurant, I go, can I talk to you for a minute? You know why I didn't do your show last year? It's because your producer said I had to do 6-minute stand-up. I haven't done stand-up in 35 years on television. He says, they would probably say, they've said that to you?
Right.
You know. Everyone's so afraid. See, you know, the one thing about getting older in this business that not everything has been successful, but I've had a great run. I had the right shows at the right time. I had Letterman only panel, and Jamie Lee Curtis for 4 years, and then I wrote a book, and then had a couple of shows that didn't work well, and then Jamie Lee Curtis, and then Larry David for 10 years, and now with Sir Patrick Stewart, and God knows how long that'll go on. He's so wonderful. So I've been lucky. I mean, I was ready. But, you know, the agents are afraid to go to bat for you because they have 5 other comics that they'll, if they go to bat for you, then they're going to, and they don't do it in a proper way, then they won't be able to book their other clients, even if they're just actors. Everybody's afraid.
Yeah.
Of losing their job.
Yeah, because it's such a volatile, you know, it's such a mercurial business across every stage that everyone's just shitting their pants all the time.
You know, I mean, when I was out here, you know, there was the Comedy Store, and you know, and I started the Improv actually, and then there was the Comedy Store, and then it's just like doing morning shows. If there's both on at 10 o'clock, if you do one, they get pissed off if you do the other. And I used to say, you know, what happened to the First Amendment here? I want to say what I want to say and wherever I want to say it. And if they don't like it, then I won't. Then screw them. And the good news was, like at the Improv and the Comedy Store, both owners liked me. And I said, look, I'm going to do a set at 8 o'clock at your show, at your club. Then I'm going to drive in 5 minutes, and I'm doing a Tonight Show, and I want to do a my monologue. So you have a problem with that? I mean, because if I just made them, if I just went on stage for a half hour and I snuck in the 6-minute monologue, and you're getting paid nothing early on, and then $7, why the fuck shouldn't I drive across town and do the monologue again?
Right.
And get $6.
It's not like they're paying you for exclusivity.
Yeah, I never took money from them anyway. I would give it to comics who had no money. I just left the money I was already touring and stuff when, you know, and then there was a strike, and then my best friend committed suicide. There's a great book out. If you're a young comic, I suggest you get I'm Dying Up Here. It's about the rock, the sex, drugs, and comedy in the 70s, and it's really a real meaningful book. It's really profound, actually. And in fact, I hear that they're going to make a movie out of it, and hopefully you'll play me. But
I would try.
Yeah, huh?
I could try, but I don't. I don't know. I'm not a great actor. Oh. I love riffing, but I also love figuring out how to evolve a joke. And then I can, you know, there's too much talking here. If I just break it up in half and put something funny here, like I love both processes.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, it's a great craft, and then it truly is a craft, and it's very, you know, there's a lot of comedians now that go on stage, and they sell out clubs, and I'm a recovered drug addict and alcoholic for 20 years now. I've been sober for 20 years. And there's a lot of comedians who aren't sober, which is fine, you know. It's their pride, it's their life. But they'll go on stage for 3 or 4 hours with a bottle of whiskey or a joint, and they'll just ramble. And that, to me, is bullshit. I mean, it's not bullshit to the owners, because the owners are, because they have a following.
Yeah.
Because half the audience is loaded. And, you know, but it has nothing to do with the craft of the history of comedy and how to write a joke and what's funny, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, it's not like I'm an old, you know, guy who's saying, oh, that, you know, I mean, I love the new edgy, great comedians. I never really watch a lot of comedians because I don't like to hear premises. I'm tragically ethical in this business, which is probably a mistake.
But you're worried that you might,
yes,
as a memory, but that's actually something.
Yeah, and I really don't like that. If someone has a horrible joke about a green turtleneck, I won't talk about green turtlenecks maybe for the rest of my life.
Right.
But, you know, I guess that's a good quality. But I mean, but you know, there's a lot of comedians that are lazy and they're not funny. And they do abuse the craft. And I'd rather see someone go up there for 25 minutes who has worked on the stuff. You know, maybe they really, you know, they like writing jokes. They like working on it, coming home, hearing it on the tape recorder, fixing it and doing it better the next night, killing the audience and getting off. Then someone up there just loaded for 3.5 hours thinking that's... That stand-up.
Did you do that before you quit? Would you go on stage? You never went on stage fucked up?
Oh, no. I was drunk sometimes, but I don't even like the word functioning alcoholic because it makes it look like your life is okay.
Right.
And it's not. But I would say only on a handful. I did about 49, 50, 55 Lettermans.
Jeez.
I would say that maybe a handful of times I had one too many wines. Dave knew that. I even wrote him a note about it. I wrote a book about it. So, I mean, but I knew, like when I did Carnegie Hall, I did 2.5 hours. That was really some night. It was really a great night. But I had like a glass of wine like 2 hours before I went on. There was no fucking way I was going to have an excuse if I didn't do a good show.
Yeah.
So I wasn't high at all. I mean, to me, that was being sober, having a little glass of red wine like at 6 o'clock with dinner. But you know, if it's 1 o'clock in the morning and it's... but no, that I was very lucky. You know, I knew somehow, somewhere in my head, that if I went on stage drunk, that I would have, my life would be over, because it was such an important part of my life, that stand-up. It was my life till I met my wife. It was the acclaim and laughs and adulation, and it was, you know, it was sort of empty until someone loved me for who I was and not for what I was, and not just as a comedian or being well-known.
Well, do you think that's why you were, one of the reasons you were passionate about being on stage? Did you feel like you were kind of searching for the family that you didn't have?
That's exactly what. In fact, you know, last year I had this. I'm only mentioning it because I'm not a good plugger, but there was it's sort of a cool box set called Bundle of Nerves, and has a movie that a couple of indies. One's called Drunks, which I'm proud of.
Oh yeah, I remember that movie.
Yeah, and it's in there. It was never out on DVD. And then I did a movie that preempted Saturday Night Live called Diary of a Young Comic. I was 28 years old. It's pretty trippy. And then there's a documentary of my house in Laurel Canyon, where we're leaving soon. And the house was built almost 100 years ago, and every inch of the house. Had photographs, I'm a collector, had photographs of iconic people. Tragically, most of them were drug addicts, you know. But, you know, you'll see Miles Davis and Lenny Bruce and Pryor and you name it, you know. And when I lived there, I lived there with many different women until I met my wife, but when I was there alone in my office, and I would turn around and I would see a poster of I know some of them now, like the Stones or Malcolm McDowell. I mean, like, you know, from Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And when I was sitting at the typewriter, I said, this is my family. Because I didn't have a family, really. I have nephews and nieces, and they have children, but I don't see them often. I love them. But my brother and my sister, I don't see much, and my father never saw me perform. My mother's gone long, and she never understood me at all. So, you know, it was when guys like Steve Allen or these old-timers would come over, and or the younger comics, like, you know, the Jeffrey Rosses, and, mm-hmm. you know, and or Sarah Silverman, and Jamie Foxx came over to me. I remember I praised him once. He went, "Oh, my God." I would get embarrassed because I don't really know who I am. I don't really, and I'm not trying to sound, you know, begging for compliments here, but sometimes I'll go over to some really, like, Oscar-winning comedians and praise them and mean it. And they'll go, "Oh, my God, I can't believe you're saying this." I go, "Why?" You know, I just feel like a fan, really. And then I guess then I realized that they were only in, like, you know, 10 or 12 when I was on Letterman, and they were up late and watching me. And it's, you know, it's sort of like I'm one of the legend. I'm like, not a legend, but I'm like an old timer now who's still hip. And they dig that. And that makes me feel cool. You know, that's a cool feeling. Because I, you know, I've never settled for doing the same shit. And, so that's a good thing. You know, I'm boasting, but I mean, it's like...
Yeah, but you're not... I mean,
I don't have kids. I have my wife and a dog. And my dog is a recovering dog. And apparently dogs that are from the streets, they don't like stand-up.
Dogs are not a good stand-up audience.
No.
They don't pay attention.
No, even when I feed the dog and do a joke, they don't laugh.
Which is basically the way a comedy club works. You feed a bunch of animals to keep them in their seat, and
that's
then you
exactly
just quickly
right.
you try to distract them so they'll keep eating.
Right, until you see someone's finger in the salad that one of the Russian chefs cut off because they were suicidal.
The dog would eat that anyway.
The dog would eat the finger.
They don't care. They don't care. But you are, I mean, you know, if you were 30 years old and you were like, "Yeah, you know, I don't know, I guess people really like me," that's one thing. But you really are.
I'm 60 fucking seven. It's a joke, man.
You really are, though. I mean, like, I'm exactly the right age to have completely absorbed the comedy boom from like 78 to 92.
Oh, wow.
I watched fucking everything.
Oh, far out.
Literally everything. Every, you know, Cinemax comedy experiment and Showtime special and all of the... You know, Caroline's and Evening at the Improv and Kamikaze and like everything.
Wow.
Everything. I watched The Tonight Show every night. I watched Letterman. Who do you think, maybe you don't know or maybe you don't get it, but who do you think cared more about comedy? Do you think, was it Dave or Johnny?
Oh, that's a good question. I think they both cared about comedy, but I think Johnny was a better audience. Because Johnny like would prefer to just sit there and laugh. Letterman was also a good interviewer because I would talk really fast and sometimes not be clear, and then Letterman would explain what I was saying to the audience, which I really appreciated. Then there are others through the years that were competitive. And but Carson, you know, everyone would probably say that Carson was the best. He was the coolest. He was, you know, for that 90 minutes, there was no one better. You know, I mean, he was he wanted you to be good. And I had an experience with him once. He's supposed to do like about 5.5 minutes, and they made it really tough on you. You had to tape it and bring it into the Tonight Show office and play it, and then they come down and see it. It just sucked the joy out of it. So I had this bit on the Division of Motor Vehicles, and it was about six minutes, not even. It was what it was supposed to be. And it was a murderously funny routine, I must say. And I'm there with one of my... I didn't get married till I was 57, so there was probably a woman with me, and I brought my agents with me, and I go on, and it's Carson who's the host, and I'm doing stand-up. I didn't have a series yet. My first series I was successful with Jamie Lee Curtis back in the late 80s, early 90s, and So I am, and usually the audience in Burbank, with all due respect, are touristy and pretty square.
It's like they're distracted by the lights and the band and the cameras and Johnny and...
Yeah, and you know, and they had the guys that come out and they went, go crazy when Johnny comes out there. They're not really saying, when Richard Lewis goes out, just scream out, we love Jews. You know, that's not going to happen. So, but you know, they want you to be good. And Johnny says his first time on TV, you know, or we know he's a crazy guy and I don't do any, that was supposed to be an impression of Carson. It could have been King Kong. But
good diction if it was King Kong.
Really good,
excellent diction. Then I think he would have lived if he had just been saying like, Mighty, "Hey guys."
Well, was Mighty Joe Young? What was his problem? Did he have? Was he dyslexic?
I think he was. I think
he was in that dance hall, and they punished him.
He was the Salieri to Kong's Mozart. I think he was just not. He was like, oh, he wanted it, but Mighty Joe Young just wasn't the same.
No, he was. He had a lot of inferiority. He should have gone to my group, my Adlerian therapist group.
He was, yes, he would have had definitely an inferiority complex, and he really
needed
help.
Then we would have had to go to the zoo for the after group.
Well, or you would have had to chase him up a building, like Larry
That's
David.
Right. Well, now he wouldn't have fit into the phone booth. So I'm doing the DMV routine on Carson, and I'm destroying this audience. And I'm midway through the routine, and I'm saying to myself, wow. And I always would think this. I would always look at, like, I would visualize apartments like in Iowa or Toronto or London. I go, they are going to see something that's going to blow their fucking heads off. Because I knew I was killing. Wait till they see this. And I knew that usually with a monologue, if you're doing great in the beginning and you get to kill a shit at the end, you know, I knew what was coming up. And I said, this is going to be one of the great shots ever. Okay? So I'm like 5 minutes in. I was in a zone, like Jordan shooting, making 50 points. And the stage manager went under the camera and told me to wrap it up. And Carson's to the 20 feet away from me, and Doc Severinsen and McMahon. And I had to make one of the toughest decisions of my life. I was only about 26. And I said, if I get off now, it's the worst monologue of all time. It makes no sense. I had a beginning, middle, and an end. You know, it was a monologue. I said, if I finish the monologue, I'll never get the show again because it's going to go at least 10 minutes. It'll be the longest monologue in history. And I said, but I'd rather kill. I wasn't thinking of them maybe editing it. I was edited a couple of times on the Ferguson show. It was sort of shocking to me.
Oh, wow.
Because I really dug doing his show, but I came back from CBS, I think it was CBS, and I told my wife, I destroyed, and I did a couple of monologues. One was on religion. Maybe that was the reason.
Oh.
And I said, what happened to the, you could see the cut, the edit. I go, oh, my God. You know, it wasn't his. No, I'm sure it wasn't Craig. You know,
right.
We worked similarly. But that was the only time that ever happened. But I wasn't thinking about that, you know, 30 years prior on the Carson show. And so I do the whole monologue. And my agents were sort of clueless about this. I walk out, and the famous talent coordinator, then he's passed on now. He's sort of an angry guy. He said to me, and I killed. It was one of the greatest killing shots. It really was a killer. I mean, the place went berserk. He says, and this is like the yin and yang of show business. I had the greatest monologue I could ever dream of on a Tonight Show. And yet as soon as I went behind the curtain, the talent coordinator said, you will never do this show again.
Oh, fuck.
And I mean, I was tortured. So then I go into my dressing room and I am so depressed.
You don't even get to enjoy the killing
at all. And the actress waitress I was dating, she sort of knew. She was a little sweeter, but my agent went. He went. Both of them were there, and they went, you did two shows in one. I went, that's the point. I did two shows. I felt like killing them. So we go to the Palm. I always used to go to the Palm. I used to love going to the Palm after the Tonight Show. And I knew I did a great shot, but I knew that it was probably the last show ever. And I was young. It was like, it would have been a murderous thing to happen. And I look up and I see Carson right across from me and his lawyer, former lawyer, who just wrote a book about him, which is pretty nasty tell-all. I mean, whether it's true or not, you know, it's up, who knows. But at any rate, like Jack Ruby, I darted over to Carson. He, you know, he gets a little nervous, and I'm doing an impression now on radio. And I got on my knees, and I begged him to understand. I said, I'm sorry. I recognize his. I knew his lawyer. I said, Mr. Bushkin, I'm sorry. I said, Johnny, look. And I knew he liked me. I said, this monologue is 5 minutes and 38 seconds. I was killing. I'm not an amateur. I'm not going to just. I had to wait for the laughs to stop and then go into the next line. I didn't want you to think I didn't know how to be a comedian. And I said, the laughs went on and on. They were so long, I didn't know what to do. I just said, I'm going to do it. And I told him about the guy telling me to stop. I said, I didn't want you to think I didn't know how to write a monologue. That would be the worst thing of all. I'd rather live the rest of my life having you think I can't go on the show because I'm too funny. That was what I was thinking. That was the decision I made. And I saw him smile a little bit. And the next day I get a phone call from the talent coordinator. He says, you're a lucky man. Everything's back to normal. Had I not run into him, I don't think I ever would have gotten
what
the show
an incredible
again.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's just unbelievable.
And how shitty that the talent coordinator still had to let you know, like.
Yeah. You still might. Yeah. You lucky bastard. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, he wasn't the nicest guy in the world.
I wonder generally. If this set must be on YouTube somewhere. It must be on the internet somewhere.
I probably have it on tape somewhere and on my storage. Yeah, and Leno said to me the next day, he says, it was the only time that I saw a guy on TV, they went to commercial and they came back and you were still on.
Oh, they didn't cut it?
No.
Oh, wow.
11 minutes.
Oh, my God.
11 minutes.
But if you're killing the whole time, you know, if like the point of the show is that it has to be entertaining, and it's entertaining.
Yeah, but
you know?
I knocked the guy who I knocked off,
was it a guy on like Riptide or something? What was it?
Something like some actor. And when I walked out, I was depressed anyway. I went, thanks a lot. You know, I went, oh, fuck you. Because I was so pissed off anyway. I didn't give a shit about him.
I think you did the right thing. It sounds to me like if you hadn't been killing and you went 11 minutes, that's one thing.
Well,
but if you're
a comic for 13 years already, I knew what I knew that I didn't want to make a fool of myself in front of Johnny Carson. He was the king.
Yeah.
And I would have. I mean, to stop. But when I saw that guy say, wrap it up, I went, yeah, wrap this up. I mean, there was no way. I mean, it was really. And then, but one, the first time, my first Tonight Show was not a good Tonight Show. And I had to wait 6 months. Johnny put me in Tonight Show prison. And I had a real reason for it not being as good as it could be. It was the best material I had after 3 years. I was on after 2.5 years. I was on. That's not. It's pretty fast to get on the Tonight Show. 2.5 years, back then at least. And I was the guy on the A team. He was the star, and he had
George Peppard.
Thank you, George Peppard. He had lung cancer, and it was an hour and a half show, and I was on like at 7 to 1. And he was on. He was the middle guest, and he was talking about dying of lung cancer.
Oh, and now here's some comedy.
Yeah, now the first time on national television, the audience is like crying. And I did have a lack of composure, one because I was freaked out, and if I was at and all of a sudden it wasn't. All you should care about as a comedian is that red light, because there are people are watching you in bed and wherever they're watching you. And even if the joke doesn't go over, smile. Because if you make it look like it's not doing well, it'll look bad.
Especially on camera where you're essentially under a microscope.
Yes. Oh, they see everything. Just smile. But I didn't know. You know, you don't know everything when you're first shot. So, but I felt like it was a nightclub when I was on there because I felt like this audience just saw a bad set from a bad comic. And I had to get the audience. In other words, I was playing to the 250 people, and that's a big mistake when there's 10 million people watching. Right. And I learned that. I learned my lesson. That was one really important lesson. And I was going, hey, some guy said something. I went, that's funny. You know, I mean, all of a sudden I'm playing, I'm at the improv at midnight. So Carson wasn't thrilled with my ad-libbing.
And you shouldn't have closed with, I just died like George Papard's gonna. Like, that was not a good way to close the set.
I don't know how I closed with my jokes, but it was, you know, it was hard to go back to the nightclubs because everyone was watching in all the clubs in New York. And it wasn't a good set. And, you know, that was my dream. I mean, that was tough to go back and work on your material, knowing, you know, not knowing when you're going to get back on the show.
And then you see all your peers and you're like, oh, they know and I know. And
it's murder. It's a tough business, man. You know, and the other thing I meant to say before, and I took me about 15 years to figure this out. You know, when you're on a show, let's say you're on Dave's show. Dave's a comedian. But, you know, he never considered himself a stand-up, but he was very funny in the clubs. And However, it's his show. It's Dave's show. I mean, he's leaving it now, but it was his show for 30 years or so. And he wants to get laughs. He deserves to get laughs. And I was always coming from a place where I needed to impress Letterman. It was like he was my family. And I would go there and I'd have in my head like home runs that I knew would get applause in the nightclubs that if I got a chance to say 10 or 15 of them, I'd kill. My goal was to kill the audience and to make Letterman proud of me like he was like the father who never saw me. Big mistake. The deal is to let the star of the show do great. And I did a show where I did about 15 one-liners, and they were murderous. Audience went wild. And I go back to the hotel, and I get a call from my publicist. They're very unhappy. I go, what? I couldn't wait to get down to the bar and have a drink. You know, I figured this was one of the great shots. And I'm mentioning, good shots, but they weren't always that great, obviously. But they were upset, and I didn't know why. I just didn't know why. And then it hit me. I don't know. No one told me. I said, wait a minute. I didn't let him talk. He didn't say one thing in 8 minutes. So the next time I came back, I made it a point to feed him like I was the host. Let him. And when he was killing, just sit back, laugh. I mean, I was funny.
What an interesting dynamic to flip his show so that he could be...
He would be the guest.
Wow. But that's so different than Carson, because Carson came from the Jack Benny school.
Yeah, he wanted to laugh.
He wanted everyone to be funny on the show.
Yeah, no, it was different. But yeah, but it's still, if Carson's on a roll, you got to let him stay on his roll.
Of course.
But this was very different, because on Letterman, I, for years, since that was my show, really, I wanted to kill on everything I said, and I forgot about him. And then I learned 5 or 6 years in that, wait a minute, if David's killing, let him kill.
God, I wonder what he's going to do. I mean, like, I look, no matter how sick you are of doing something over and over and over again, when that's your pattern every day for 30 years, like, what do you, I don't know. Carson seemed to embrace it, but I think... I don't know.
Well,
I
wonder, he left early, and he was fairly young when he left.
I wonder if Dave's going to go crazy from not having a thing to do, that sort of
regimen. Well, he produces shows, but that has nothing to do with sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you get the feeling with Dave that he doesn't enjoy it, but he has to. He would quit. He would have quit way before. It's not about money.
I don't know if he... Look, I don't know him. I've never done the Letterman show, which is a bummer, and now it's going to be too late. But I think... as an audience member, it feels like he's not really that into it, and he hasn't been for a while. Of course, I don't know him. But I think, if anything, it seems like he needs the process of it. And I think, I'm just guessing, it seems coincidental that
it was not that long after Leno announced that he was leaving, and then a few months later, Letterman's like, okay, I'm done. It almost felt like I won the race.
All right.
But who knows? Who knows?
You just don't know, you know, and they're all very different. You know, I think the most fun I've ever had on any show, generally speaking, was with Jon Stewart,
mm-hmm.
who I introduced on an HBO special. And
The Young Comedian. It was one of the Young Comedian specials. Yeah.
And he was a real fan. I mean, a big fan. And when I would go into the Daily Show, he would never ask me anything. No one would ask me anything. It would just be free fall. It was sort of like Ferguson. Ferguson was that way too. That was really a rare thing. But that was cool. But on The Daily Show, which was such a big show, just to be able to say anything you wanted without him caring or knowing, it was just really a blast. I really missed doing that show.
Well, you know, he trusted you as a performer, and he probably enjoyed being surprised by whatever it was that you were going to...
I guess, a lot.
If he's a fan of yours, he's even though he's hosting the show, he's going to be watching you like an audience member. Like, he gets a front row seat.
In a way, I guess, yeah. I mean, it's sort of scary talking to you about, and you're really bright and funny and intelligent and all of the rest, but, you know, to be this old and to have done this for 45 years, it is sort of spooky knowing that I'm, you know, in the third act of this. And when you mention about Letterman, it's like, whoa, you know, I'm in good health and everything, but, you know, and I'm in a show and all this and that, and it's all cool, but, you know... I can't imagine not going on stage again unless I'm sick. I mean,
yeah, but you don't have to though. I mean, you can perform as long as you want.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, not to go on stage. I mean, as frightening as it is to hear my name, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Lewis, because I don't know what I'm going to say. I still need it, and not to have that fear in my life. Sort of stupid to say, not to feel that. You know, not to know that tonight, you know, it's 4 o'clock and I'm going to be going on in 4 hours or whatever it is. It's like, I don't know, man. I mean, you got to quit sometime.
Yeah.
Most people, you know, they quit, they become actors, or they do direct TV shows and all that shit.
I think
shit.
You quit when you, I think it doesn't matter how old you are. I think comedy is kind of a hungry man's game, and if you're hungry until you're 95, then great. Joan was,
right?
You know, Mel Brooks is still that way,
right?
You know,
Paul
I mean,
Reiner, my God,
you know, it's like it doesn't. I think a lot of
if
people.
If you're hungry, yeah.
If you're hungry, but I think at a certain point, a lot of guys are just like, I don't need it. And they're comfortable, and they don't really, you know, the grind and the amount of energy that. But if you're hungry for 100 years, then you can perform for 100 years. I think that's all.
You know, it's really something too. When if you quit, audiences don't. People will see you on the street. Gee, I haven't seen you in a long time, and I feel like saying, "Well, you saw me for 50 years. Isn't that enough, asshole?" You know, it really. There was. I'll never forget that. I was in an airport. And it was one of these days. I had a special on a dramatic movie. I had a book out. I was like one of these hot months, okay? And I was on 3 talk shows, and it was like really, my wife was flying with me, and it was really one of those great 3 or 4 weeks. And there was a woman, and I was at an airport waiting for our flight, and we were at a cafe, and I went to get a bagel. And this woman says to me, she says, "Richard Lewis, right?" I go, "Yeah, how are you?" She says, "You're never on anything anymore." And I go, "Well, you know, it doesn't mean you're not watching the right channel, but perhaps that's really where it's at, because I've never been busier in my life." And she said to me, "That's not true. You don't do a thing anymore." I said, no, this is probably the high point of my career. She says, "No, you're lying to me. You're done." And I said, "Hold on a minute." I said, "Joyce, you got to come over here." And I said, "This is my wife." "Oh, I'm sorry." I said, "Well, no, I mean, because I'm done, you know. I have a gorgeous wife." And she says, "Your husband's finished, isn't he?" It was the most
That's so strange.
It was the strangest thing.
Usually people just do that anonymously on the internet. I mean, it's impressive that someone would actually do that in person.
Yeah. The best time that when I was not recognized was that I kept going past a stop sign near in my neighborhood. Without stopping, I would just go through it. And I got stopped 6 days in a row. And the cop thought I was Richard Belzer.
Oh, no.
He went, Bells, Bells. And because I, you know, Bells played the cop.
Yeah.
He says, I'm going to give you a break, but Bells, come on. 6 days in a row. The cop is always hiding. I always forgot. And then he, Bells. And I finally, the seventh time, I went, give me the fucking ticket. I'm Richard Lewis.
Did he give you the ticket?
I couldn't, yes. I couldn't take it. I was fucking pissed off. I'm not Belzer. I'm Richard Lewis. I don't want to be... I'd rather go to jail and be known for who I am.
You know, I think a lot of it also has to do with why people do it. And if people do it because they want to get rich, then the second they're rich, they don't have to do it anymore. If they want to do it to get famous and they're famous, it's like, well, they achieved
their
goal.
Oh, I never did it for...
If your goal is just to do comedy...
Express myself.
Then that's never going to go away.
Probably not.
So, yeah, I mean, I it doesn't seem like you have anything to worry about. But then again, if you don't worry, then you don't try harder. It's like that fire, you know, you got to have a little bit of that fire all the time.
Yeah. Well, when I don't know what if I did the same act, I would have quit a long time ago.
Oh, well, let me ask you this. Were you worried? This might be a dumb question, but when you finally met the woman that you married,
right?
And obviously you love her and you're very happy with her.
Yeah, it's a good marriage.
Was there anything where you thought, oh, shit, well, if I get too comfortable, am I not going to be a comic? I mean, like, is this going to take away from...
No, because I'm a basket case and, you know, and the marriage is fraught with insanity.
Oh, good. Well, that's good for comedy.
Oh, it's phenomenal. But we understand it. We understand it. I mean, she understands, she appreciates my eccentricities. And I always needed that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I didn't, you know, I met her in her early 40s. And so she was younger than me, but she wasn't like, you know, as I used to say, she didn't think, what did I say, Serpico was a cheese. So, I mean, she, you know, she understood things. And I always, you know, was with people, you know, 20 years younger than me, and I couldn't, you know. It was all bullshit. I mean, they were smart. Some of them were smart, but crazy. You're better when you don't do drugs. You drink more. You know. You know. Actually, it was the reverse. No. Don't. You know. When you drink, you get angry. When you ecstasy is better. You know. It was. No. I found somebody who was. She's not an addict, but she never saw me drink. So that's sort of cool.
Yeah. So she didn't know you as that guy.
No, she not. But she, when I was doing a series with Jamie Lee Curtis, she was asked if she wanted to go out with me, and she said he's too nuts. So we probably would have had a family. Had you know, but she probably would have thrown me in rehab, knowing her. But you know what? You can't go back. You know, I met her at the right time. You know, so it was cool.
I think a lot of the walls that get built are ones that people just invent. You know, like in terms of
the walls
for like, oh, I can't perform if, or I can't do this, or I'm not going to be funny anymore if this, or, you know, like, I feel like people create a lot of their, but I think if you just shut up and keep doing it, then it's fine, you know?
Without thinking too much about
it. Yeah. Because when you think too much about it, you just get in your own way. And that's the voice that says like, well, this isn't funny. You might not be funny anymore. Why are you still doing this? Why are you, you know, it's just going to, yeah. It's just like if you can just ignore that and get that out of the way.
Well, the greatest negative voice I ever had, and I've said this before, but when I was, my first Tonight Show, I auditioned out here, flew in from New York, and I got the show, and I was staying at some cheap motel on Sunset Strip, and I called my mother, and I said, Mom, I'm going to be on Johnny a week from Thursday. And she said, who else is on?
Oh, so Jesus Christ.
That's pretty much a reason to go to the Roxy and get loaded. Oh, no. I mean, really, it just doesn't get much worse than that.
No.
But
that's pretty fucked up.
It is fucked up.
Well, because she didn't think. I don't, you know what? I'm not going to analyze now. I'd rather hope she, her soul, if there is a soul, is she's floating around and not watching me.
Do you think would you have wanted her to be any different way if it would have made you?
I wouldn't have been as.
Right.
If I'm good, I would never have been as good.
Maybe. Do you think that know. Made you know, or would you you have taken your chances and wanted it to be?
I don't think I even would have been driven to go on stage if I had parents that were more there for me and loving.
Yeah,
I had a fucked up upbringing. You know, I was alone, and I needed an audience. I really did. I mean, I there's no way that I would have been. Whoever I became, I never would. If I was good, I wouldn't have been as good. You know, it's just no doubt in my mind. If I had a loving family, and I had, you know, there was some love there, but I'm just saying, it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't abused, but I wasn't appreciated.
Yeah.
I was like left to my own devices, and that didn't work out too well for a long time. So, no, I think that it was good for me. Ultimately, that the family sucked.
And then when you finally figured out, oh, this audience thing is obviously I'm trying to piecemeal a family, then at that point, did you find a different reason to go on stage? Do you think it was still the same? Once you sort of figured out, like, oh, I'm looking for, you know, the thing that the family didn't provide.
No, it fed the monster. The more I got laughs, the more I realized, the darker I got.
Yeah,
it gave me more courage. This is really a funny story. I just thought of it. I don't know if we ever have time, but I was, I did Carnegie Hall in '89 in December, and I get a call from my agent saying there's a lot of money for an hour show in the Catskills. And now I never played the Catskills. That was not for me. That was like 3,000 people eating food.
Right.
And children, and it would have been the way, you know. So I say, oh, God. And I wasn't sober then either. But the money was so huge for an hour. I just said, God, how can I really pass on this? Carnegie Hall was a huge success. So I got a limo, a model, four friends, champagne. I tell the driver, keep the engine running. Keep it running. I knew it was going to be a nightmare. I had no idea what nightmare this would be. They say, ladies and gentlemen, and this is like a week after, like, you know, 2.5 hours, two standing, you know, Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
So I was still feeling that way, but I knew that I was in a bad, I think it was Seinfeld said, there's no such thing as a bad audience. That's bullshit. You know, if you do a corporate gig at a Klansman rally, at least for me.
It's a bad audience.
Bad. Not turning them around. So, ladies and gentlemen, Rich, and I'm walking and I'm seeing 3,000 people. And it's not so much about Jews and eating and all that, but it had a lot to do with why it hurt. Because when they said, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Lewis, and I heard no applause.
Oh, yeah, you know.
No applause except 3,000 people saying, I didn't get pears. That's a lot of people saying things like that. Give me my, don't suck on my spoon. It was, so I didn't get one laugh. And I had the check in my pocket, a big check. And I said to the audience, I looked at my watch. I went, I have 22 minutes to go and I'm going to finish. Because I did not want to give the money back. There's no way. And I finished. I got off. And I got off to, I want my pears. It was the same thing. And I go back to this suite that looked like my grandmother's house in Brooklyn. It was like an older hotel, you know, the Grossingers. It was the Concord, I think. And I don't think it's there anymore. And I get a note from the owner's son, who was a big fan of mine. And he sent me, he didn't know that I would be gone in a minute. He sent me a bottle of great champagne. But it was the note that really mattered. He says, you can't be all things to all people.
Oh, my God. How insightful.
Beautiful. It's a great note. So we go into the to the stretch, and we go back to Manhattan. I got the bread. You still feel like shit when you bomb, but that note meant a lot to me, you know. And something happened that really, I'll mention it. I don't like talking about people that have passed on, but it was something that he made up for. He passed on. He used to, he was married to Liza Minnelli. He was a pianist. He was very, really terrific.
Marvin Hamlisch?
No, it wasn't Marvin Hamlisch. He was a pianist, and he was one of her three or four husbands, and he was... He played lounges and the Carlisle and all these places, and he was really great. And he was there to play the night after me. And someone, and my uncle, who was divorced when I was eight, I hadn't seen. He was at the gig that I was there when I bombed, and he told these people, must have been in his 60s at the time, probably, and he said, "That's my nephew." Of course, I hadn't seen him in a long, long time. And when I bombed, he told me this because I had seen him. He lived till he was 98, and my cousin brought him out to live in California. It was beautiful. And he told me, he says, "You know, after you bombed," he told the people, "I think he's my nephew." Which I said, "That's fucking great. I wish I would have used that on it." So... what's this guy's name? I can't think of it. It doesn't matter. Peter Allen. Yeah, Peter Allen. Terrific performer. He saw the show. And I had a friend who called me a month later. He says, "You know, Peter Allen came on, and he was great." No, he killed. You know, that's what you do with either a Borscht Belt comic or you're a singer. And Peter Allen came on, and the first thing he said is, "God, I hope I do better than Richard Lewis."
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, really. So about 3 years later, I'm at the Four Seasons going over some notes, and I see him. I go, "Hi, Peter." "Hi, Richard." I go, "Could you come here a minute?" And I sit him down, and I said, "I got to tell you something, man." I said, "I've been a comedian for a quarter of a century." And I said, "I played the Concord the week after I sold out Carnegie Hall, and I've had a really good run. I'm in a series now with Jamie Lee Curtis, and I had a bad night. And you come out, and you couldn't just do your show. You had to bring that back to the attention of those people." I go, "What gives you the balls to do that, man? This is a tough enough business." I was really angry. And he just got on his knees. Well, I mean, he got on his knees, but that's where it ended. But he apologized profusely, you know, and he realized, he was almost crying.
Oh.
I really felt badly. I said, "You know, this is a tough fucking business we're in. You don't have to make it harder on my..." I felt horrible that night. Why bring it up? Do your show, man.
Did you feel better after you knew that he felt bad about it?
I felt great about it because I knew that I was right. And he could have gone the other way, like, "Go fuck yourself," you know. Yeah. But he says, "You know, you're right. I had no right doing that. And I feel horrible about it." I said, "Well, you know, don't beat yourself up. But I'm glad that I had the opportunity to tell you because I was looking for you." It was like a bad Western on television. You know, like the guy with the one-arm bandit, you know, the one-arm guy looking for the doctor. You know, I mean, I was looking for this guy for like 10 years.
Do you only as, are you only as happy as your most recent show? Was it hard for you? Okay,
no
good.
More. Back in the old days?
Yeah.
Oh, God. You wear it like a cloak, like Ingmar Bergman's store on Melrose.
Like, if you were doing a weekend at a club, you can have five great shows, but if your sixth show isn't that great, you leave going, "Oh, my God, what am I doing?"
God, you go to the airport wearing an Abe Lincoln beard. God, you feel like shit.
What about those other? I know, but the last one, that's the residue I'm leaving with. It's that last show.
You know, I actually, after 43 years, I didn't have a breakdown, but I was not treated very well at a corporate gig. And this was like a month after I got one of the greatest reviews of my life in Chicago from a jazz critic. And but I hadn't slept in 3 days. And that, in combination with no, with being treated, missing the car to the gig, 20 degrees, not knowing how I was going to get to the gig, waiting 3 hours to go on, meet and greet, photographs. They introduced me, and I was having like an out-of-body experience. And it was the scariest gig I've ever had. I went, and I knew that I had, if I didn't stop, I mean, the show was horrible. And this was an interesting story because I got reviewed. You never get reviewed for a corporate gig.
Oh, that is weird.
And I read the review, and the review was written beautifully. And he says, Rulis was a raving lunatic. And I was. I couldn't, and I was calling my wife. They put me down in a locker room for 2 hours to wait for this opening act. And I read the review when I came home, and I called the guy, and I didn't. And everyone said, "Forget it, man. You know, it's one show." I said, "No, I can't forget this. It wasn't fair. I didn't sleep for 3 days. I tore my rotator lifting it happened when I was there. I couldn't see straight. I wasn't in a good place." And I felt, you want to apologize to people, I mean, I'm a people pleaser. It's a bad thing to be a people pleaser and a stand-up, you're just not going to please everybody.
Yeah, it's a bad thing to be a people pleaser at the expense of your own happiness.
Absolutely. So I called, I didn't care what my publicist said, my wife, I called the newspaper and I said, because I saw the name of the guy, I went, "Hi, this is Richard Lewis." He says, Richard Lewis? I go, "Yeah." Comedian, he went, I'm like, "Wow, well, you're right." I'm fine. I said, "I've never called a critic in my entire life, but I had to call you." And I told him, I said, "Let me just tell you something. First of all, I have never been reviewed at a corporate gig, which are normally nightmares. They are. They're not run well. They're horrible. You get a lot of money, but it's not worth it."
Right.
And I said, "Your review was written beautifully, and you were dead right. But let me tell you what I went through." And I told, I said, "Were you listening?" He said, "Yes." I said, "And I'm not calling for another story. I beg of you not to do this. Do not write. This is off the record. But I want you to know, because you're a good writer, that you judged my 39 minutes after 43 years based on this." And when I told him, the guy went, "Oh my God, why did I do it? I mean, it was the same thing." Those are the only two times that I really felt I needed. I told, that singer, and yeah, I told this critic, I said, first of all, I felt I was pissed at you for, what about the 40 years of the success I had? So I had a bad gig. And I, granted, I was a madman, and here's why. I didn't sleep for 72 hours. I had a torn rotator, and I was in a gym looking at pictures of dead presidents of the Jewish Center. I mean, give me a fucking break. The guy started, he didn't laugh because he felt, but I felt better when I hung up.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to do these things. People will tell you, agents, wives, girlfriends, you name it, don't do it, And sometimes they're right. You should just let it go and just work on the next show. But sometimes, I take things so seriously. If I feel that I'm getting fucked over in a way that's not fair, it's hard for me to let it go. That's just me.
Well, I think it's important it's important to be heard, and it's important to feel understood. It's important to feel understood. And when you feel like someone is judging you without all the facts, they don't understand you, it feels like there's something that's not in balance. And so when you can say, and if the guy had said, "Well, go fuck yourself," then you can go, "Well, at least I expressed how I felt," then you probably would have still felt okay.
Right.
Right. But I think it's important to try to get understanding, especially when it's something that you care about.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. I really do.
You, this book.
Yeah, I know. I think I've ruined your Paris vacation. I've been here so long.
You haven't ruined anything. I mean, I honestly,
it's so wonderful to hear you talk, and it's so great to hear someone who's been doing stand-up for 45 years that still gives a shit about actually just getting up and performing. Like, it makes me, you know, it continues to inspire people.
Well, that's very nice of you to say.
And it's nice because you really do care about the craft of it, and it seems like that's your main focus.
That's
and all the other stuff doesn't.
That's all that matters. And then if you get a break, then you're ready. That's it, man. You know, I'll be brief. I have an artist friend who I've been a patron to, and so is Larry David, called Nicholas Totolo. He's a New York artist, and he's brilliant. And I came up with an idea of coming up with dark thoughts. This is not to be grandiose, but there was a book similar. I didn't know this, that Edgar Allan Poe would write like a couple of lines, and Edward Manet, this French impressionist, would illustrate it. So I would give him 10 or 12 thoughts. He picked one that would inspire him. So we wound up with a book called Reflections from Hell. It's a guide on how not to live. That's sort of a little, you know, power thing. Make a joke out of it. But the illustrations are amazing. The guy's a genius. And so I'm proud that I have a book with Mr. Totolo. And also this year we just wrapped a series on Stars, which starts this summer with Sir Patrick Stewart, who plays this drugged out, horrible father, real progressive news guy. And I'm the network psychiatrist. So, and I try to help this crazy network try to stay on the air. Me. But it's cool. I like acting. And so it's like I'm really going against type, way against type. You know.
Well, that's acting. That's good.
Yeah. So the book is cool. The book comes out on the 5th of May, and the show starts in the summer. So it's a good time, and I'll be on tour. I'm going to be in New York and Chicago in May, so everything's cool.
Where are you playing in New York?
Caroline's at the end of the month. Nice. And I've been playing Zany's
in Chicago, the downtown,
for 35 years, yeah.
It's a fun club.
Oh, it's a great club. I mean, I've done a lot of specials in the theaters there, but there's nothing like when they're that little club downtown on Wall Street. They're right on top of you. And,
oh, yeah, the stage is a bar.
Yeah, if you screw up... they're like vampire bats.
Yeah.
It's over.
There's probably a picture of you on the wall there from 1982 or something.
It's pretty scary. It's like a day glow picture of me. I thought I was doing drugs again when I saw it.
The one in Nashville, the Zanies in Nashville, is the same. It's like guys that you grew up watching where they were fucking kids in their headshot. You know?
Yeah, I know. There's one with an umbilical cord of me in one club in Brooklyn. It's been a real honor.
Oh, and
pleasure,
please, of course. It's amazing to talk to you, and I really hope you come back sometime. And you know, if you're doing spots around town just for fun, you know.
That's right. By the way, Michael McEwen is an old buddy of mine, and that show you did with him was just spectacular.
Oh, thank you.
He's really a genius. I consider him a genius, and I'm so happy he got that role. You know, on the
on Saul. Yeah,
he's brilliant in it. He's really, and people should go back and go on YouTube and see the improv group he was in with, you know, when he was with us, that guy on that famous show.
Laverne and Shirley, David Lander.
Yeah, but he was with David and him. What was the name of the group he was with? It was the three of them.
Yeah, it was, we talked about
it. And
him.
It was with, what's his name, that genius, that the guy who does that show every Sunday, Le Show.
Oh, yeah, Harry Shearer.
The three of them.
Yeah.
They were amazing, and there's an album that you can get, and you can listen, get it on YouTube or get it on iTunes. It doesn't get much better. I mean, like they're like SCTV, those guys, you know, they're just amazing.
It's on McKean's Wikipedia page.
Yeah, it would be.
What's it called? It was the Credibility Gap.
Credibility Gap. Yeah. Oh, man.
The Credibility
Doesn't
Gap.
Doesn't get much better. These guys, they're really brilliant.
Yeah,
brilliant.
And so nice. It still freaks me out every once in a while. He'll include me in a tweet, and I'll be like, Jesus Christ. Like, it still flips,
great?
It still flips me out.
No, that's really great.
But it's good to see you. And
no, thanks for having me.
Please.
It was a pleasure.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.